do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Greetings and welcome back to the podcast. This is the place where we empower you to build trust, champion adaptability, and cultivate the courage to unlock your DNA of purpose. Today, we are diving into these pressing questions. What does it take to spark a thriving community? How can you foster that magnetic pull that attracts and nurtures a community's growth? And importantly, how do you build momentum while maintaining the delicate balance of igniting a community's passion without stifling the very essence that brought individuals together in the first place? Now, if you are a changemaker, a purpose-driven leader, or an entrepreneur driving forward an idea, an initiative, managing a purpose-driven team, or a business, then today could be the game changer you have been waiting for in relation to how you mobilize people around a core purpose. And let me give you a little hint. That mobilization has very little to do with a grand and lofty statement of why. Today, I am honored to introduce you all to the King of Community himself, here to decode the road forward for all of us. Say hello to David Spinks, a passionate expert in the world of communities. He dedicates his time to studying communities and educating others on how they function. David is known for his insightful weekly newsletter where he delves into community theory, and he is also the author of a book which literally has not left my desk, The Business of Belonging. Previously, David was a co-founder of CMX, the renowned annual conference and community boasting over 20,000 community professionals. In 2019, CMX was acquired by Bevy, a platform specializing in hosting chapter-based community ecosystems. For 3 years, David served as the VP of Community at Bevy. And in addition to all of that, for 2 years, he was also the host of the podcast Masters of Community, where he interviewed the world's leading community builders and experts. Today, some of the themes David and I explore include the importance of belonging and community, delving into the biological and neurological basis for our need for community, with a focus on what David refers to as social health. We discuss how leaders can ignite and strengthen communities, highlighting key elements and also taking a deep dive into some of the common pitfalls. David outlines the spaces model for community success, exploring the interplay of social identity and meaning making. He shares strategies for managing behavioral change and guiding communities through transformation. We contemplate the role of exponential progress and artificial intelligence in community building and its potential to complement humanity. And we also explore the intersection between future of work trends like remote working, community, and what it takes to fundamentally nourish our social diets. And really, that is just the beginning. Just like David himself, this episode is jam-packed with value. With a wealth of experience and a passion for bringing people together, David is here to share his insights and guide us on the journey of building meaningful, thriving communities. So let's dive in and explore the art and the science of community building, and of course, the business of belonging, with the one and only David Spinks. David Spinks, thank you so much for joining me on the DNA of Purpose podcast. It is such a pleasure having you beam in all the way from New York City today. Welcome.
Thank you. Very excited to be here. Although technicality, I am in the suburbs of New York City, so I don't want to mislead anybody thinking, you know, I'm a city guy in the suburbs now.
You're a suburbs guy. We've got that.
I am now, unfortunately, yes.
Beautiful. Well, look, I want to dive straight on into a question that I ask all the guests on the podcast. Now, as you can imagine, over the years, I've asked a lot of questions. This podcast has now been going for 5 seasons, and I've had the privilege of asking them to some of the most purpose-driven leaders, change makers, and consultants on the planet. So what I'm curious to know is, what great questions do these people ask of themselves? So with that in mind, what burning question are you currently pondering that is guiding your work forward?
Good question. I think I'm finding myself very curious about the concept of social health, or what I've been calling social fitness, and understanding how can someone improve their social health the same way we exercise to improve our physical health, we go to therapy, or read and learn, or get support to help with our mental health. Our social health is extremely important. We're learning that more and more today. More research is coming out about how important social health is, but there's very little information or support or services or systems out there to help people actually improve their social health and understand it. And so I find myself really fascinated with that question, going down a lot of rabbit holes in that space these days.
Mm. How would you define social health? Are you talking specifically about our connection to relationship, our connection to the community? What does that constitute?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there's a lot of nuance there. Mm. And so when we, you know, a question that I've been asked 1,000 times in my career is, what is a community, or how do you define a community? And we talk a lot about belonging. We've talked a lot about loneliness. And these are all really meaty terms that are thrown around kind of haphazardly, but there's so much nuance behind them. And so when we talk about social health, which I think people use kind of interchangeably with belonging, right? We say, like, do I feel a sense of belonging? Does someone belong? Do they have belonging in their life? What we're really asking is, do they feel socially healthy or socially fit? And so turns out there's many different forms of social health, or many different factors that go into social health. We might think it's just having close friends or being close with our family, but there's much more to it than that. There's different forms of loneliness as well. And so, yeah, I mean, for example, there's, I recently learned about research into loneliness and research into social health that goes back pretty far. So there's a paper from 1983 by Daniel Russell and Carolyn Citrins that break down the 6 provisions for social health. And there's a lot of studies like this that essentially try to capture what it is that we're talking about here and take a research-based approach to it. This study was specifically in the context of stress. So people who are experiencing stress in their life, what kind of social support systems were really helpful for them? And those 6 provisions that they found were, 1 is attachment. So our emotional attachment to other people. 2 is social integration. So do you feel like you're with people who have common interests and passions and jobs or hobbies, people who have similarities to you? 3 is guidance. So people who can provide you actual advice or information or support that can help you in those moments. 4 was a reliable alliance. So are they people that you feel like you can count on at points when you need them in the future? 5 was reassurance of worth. So does the group reassure you that you have value, that you are useful to other people? And 6 was the opportunity for nurturance, which was the sense that others rely on you for their own well-being, that they can count on you to nurture them, right? So it's so interesting to take this very general idea of belonging or connection and start to understand there's like different ways that we experience that. And the study found that we actually need all six to some degree. We need a balance of all six to truly feel social healthy. And socially healthy. And so this is actually one of the studies that led to the creation of something called the UCLA Loneliness Score, which is what's being used to track loneliness across the US, across the world. It's one of the most common ways of measuring loneliness in societies. And so we can kind of gauge how lonely are people in society using these kinds of factors and getting scores around them. And so, yeah, it's fascinating. I could keep going down the rabbit hole with more of that kind of stuff. The different kinds of loneliness is fascinating, how you can be lonely from friends and family. You can be lonely on a universal level. Like you can feel lonely, like in the universe, you can feel lonely on a purpose level and not feeling like you have something that you're working toward. You can feel lonely on a more passive level and feel like I'm living in a neighborhood, but no one smiles or says hi to each other, even if it's really small interactions. So it's a multifaceted topic that, you could spend a long time diving down that rabbit hole.
Absolutely. And a beautiful reminder that in the words of Ram Dass, I believe that we're all just walking each other home. So I want to go down this rabbit hole a little bit further and understand a little bit more about the neuroscience of belonging, because what you're talking about here, as it turns out, has been with us since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's another really exciting rabbit hole you can go down. So
Let's do it.
Yeah. It's fascinating, especially in the context of how remote we are today, to learn about the ways that connection affects our brains and affects our physiology. And so there's actually a study that's pretty recent. There's still only preliminary results where they put two people in MRI machines and track their brain waves. And then they had each of them had headphones so they could talk to each other. And they were asked to do a pretty typical improv exercise of coming up with a story together, right? So one could say there was a boy walking in the woods, and then the next person would say, and he went down a dark path, and the next person say he came up to a house, and the next person say, and there was an old woman in it, and the next person say she was 7 feet tall, right? So you just build on it and build on it, and they tracked their brain waves as they got deeper and deeper into creating this story together. And as they started, As the story got deeper, they found that their brain waves actually started to synchronize. And then they asked people afterward, to what level they felt connected, were they enjoying the experience? And the people who felt more connected and felt more joy had a greater synchronization in their brain waves, right? So our brain waves actually synchronize when we feel deeply connected to people. And we know that our hormones will start to also align when we're feeling really connected to people. There was a study that tracked a rowing crew, and as they got into the routine of rowing and working together, their hormones started to align, right? So the way our minds and our bodies release cortisol and dopamine, it all starts to align. And so we have these very physical reactions to connecting with other people. And things as simple as eye contact can release dopamine in your body and release chemicals in your body. So it's one thing that we don't get on Zoom calls, right? You can't actually make eye contact. We're only using two of our senses, right? We can't smell the room. We're not seeing the same things around us. The lighting is different around us. There's so many things that we're not capturing when we're only in remote settings. And so, it makes sense. This is how we were wired. This is how we evolved. The reason that humans evolved beyond other human species is literally because of our ability to form larger groups. Our ability to believe in something is actually what led us to something that's beyond the physical realm, right? Like a purpose, getting right into it. Having a shared purpose is what allowed us to form much larger groups than the other human species that could only form groups with, the physical people around them the physical needs that they had to, you know, eat and protect. That's all they could do. But Homo sapiens could believe that that rock has purpose, that the sky has purpose, that there's a God, that there's some other larger reason. And that allowed us to exceed, you know, what we call Dunbar's number, 150 people. It allowed us to grow these large groups. And that's, you know, we weren't smarter, we weren't bigger, we weren't stronger than some of the other human species, but we outsurvived them because of our groups. So it's literally wired into how we evolved. And so it makes perfect sense that when we truly feel connected to each other, there's some very physical responses that we have. And we have this equilibrium state that we are constantly trying to reach for our social health, that if we are not reaching the level of social connection that we expect, we start to develop a craving, right? And it's actually, I just learned this on Andrew Huberman's podcast, that it's the same exact part of your brain that gets triggered when you crave food, when you're hungry, or even water, that triggers when you feel lonely and you start to have a craving for social connection. The same exact neurons in your brain are responding to that, and the same dopamine releases in your body react to that, to the extent that they ran studies and they would have people be socially isolated and then show them a whole number of images of different objects and people and food. And they found when they showed them pictures of food, it actually triggered their craving just because they were socially isolated, even though they weren't necessarily hungry. And the same happened when they had them fast and not eat. They had higher need for social interaction because it's the same part of the brain that's being triggered. So, you know, I've heard people say that social connection is like, you know, food and water in terms of our hierarchy of needs as humans. And I've always kind of like rolled my eyes at that a little bit, but it turns out there's actually a lot of truth to it. And now we know that a lack of social connection hurts our health in a very serious way. And it literally kills us. So maybe it's not that much of a stretch.
Yeah, look, I love that. And what you've just shared speaks to me in relation to, I guess, my understanding of purpose, because I find it really interesting that so often when we talk about purpose, we talk about it being my why, you know, it's this kind of individual solo pursuit for meaning, where I actually don't think we can experience purpose without this sense of belonging. And the neuroscience you have just shared, the fact that we are hardwired for social health actually speaks to this idea, because we need that social context in order to be able to create meaning and essentially have the experience of feeling a purpose. I love what you've just shared. However, I want to dive back into your story in a little more detail. I have just spent, much of the last 24 hours delving into the business of belonging, how to make community your competitive advantage. And I know today has been a conversation that will add so much to my community. However, before going there, I'd love to learn a little bit more about your life. Growing up, I know you grew up in an immigrant family. Your dad was Irish and your mum from Israel. They moved to the USA where you were born. In the book, you mentioned feeling new and different growing up and perhaps a little bit out of place. How did this foundational experience and your experiences, more broadly speaking, growing up, shape your quest to unlock belonging and in turn guide you towards discovering your life purpose?
Yeah, I think it's how it goes, right? You know, it's the thing that you struggle with most becomes a strength later. And it's almost like a puzzle that was presented to me at a very early age. And the more I tried to solve that puzzle, the more I learned how complex it is. And even as I figured out how to find connection for myself after struggling with it as a child, you know, it just sent me down this path of trying to understand connection, understand community. And already we've covered, you know, how nuanced this topic is. So it's a puzzle that has infinite solutions. And I mean, what fun is that to be able to spend your life trying to solve it? And so I think it just triggered this curiosity for me in how people connect. My parents were immigrants. I was born a year after they moved to the US. And, you know, you don't realize that when you're a kid, you only know your parents from the point you were born. And you only know the reality you were born into. But now in hindsight, understanding the world more, having a lot more experience, you know, it must have been really unique for me to grow up in that setting where my parents didn't know anyone when they came to the US. We had one family, like my uncle, aunt, and four cousins lived in our town. Outside of that, we didn't know anybody. We didn't have an established network. We didn't have roots. And so my parents were building their community and growing their roots the same time I was born. And so where other kids typically grow up in a place where there's some connection, some established network, we didn't have that. And it's interesting to think back about how a kid must experience that and how I experienced that. Culturally, our home was different as well, right? They came from Israel, and my dad was born in Ireland, lived in England for much of his life. So that's not too different from the US. Israel was a bit more different. It led me to struggle with finding belonging and connection, but I was someone who always craved it. I was an extrovert, which interestingly, I've learned more about extroversion recently and how it doesn't mean I value connection any more than an introvert. It just means I actually need a lot more connection to reach that balanced level of social health, to feel whole. And so I needed a lot more social interaction and I craved it more, but I couldn't get it. You know, I was excluded. I would have friends and then have falling outs. I would, set out on my bike some days just looking for someone to hang out with, like hoping I'd run into people that would let me hang out with them. So it was I had a lot of lonely experiences at a young age that drove me to, be curious about it and just pay really close attention to how people connected. And I would look at people who were popular, who seemed to have a really innate ability to connect with other people. And I remember just paying very close attention to the details, like where their eyes were looking and the way they smiled and the timing of their jokes and how they held their bodies. And I just wanted to know, I wanted to know, like, how do you connect with people? How do you become likable? And so, by the time I got to college, I became pretty good at it and I became very social and the person who I like to connect with all the groups. I didn't want just one group. I like to be a bridge between the entire ecosystem and be a connector. And that's ultimately what became my career. I've been doing community for my whole career. And then I built the community for community managers to help other people do this work professionally. And, I even did a sabbatical for about a year recently. And, I went on sabbatical thinking, I think I'm going to try something else now. Maybe I'll be a musician or an artist or a farmer or, try a different line of work. Maybe I'll learn how to code. And I came back and I was just still very curious about community and I'm still asking a lot of the same questions, but I really enjoy it.
I love that. I love that passion. And I can see it in you, in the way you're talking about your subject today. And, it's a testament to what it takes to master a subject, because this is obviously something that has been inside of you since those early days. And what an incredible journey you've had. Just to frame up some of what you just shared, by the age of 14, you built your first community around your favorite video game, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4. And then by college, you started a successful community-focused blog. You went on to co-found CMX by 2014, establishing an annual conference and a thriving community of over 20,000 professionals, during which time you attracted speakers from companies such as Lyft, Airbnb, 500 startups, and Apple. In fact, CMX was so successful that in 2019, Bevy, known for their chapter-based community platforms, acquired CMX. Now, this undeniably sounds like a wild ride, but apart from your obvious community building know-how, what were the key trends that converged over that period of time that today have ushered us into an era where community building is arguably the most vital skill for any leader, entrepreneur, or change maker?
Yeah. I mean, I think community has always been a vital skill. I think just the flavor and the context have changed. I think businesses have started taking it a lot more seriously as something to invest in. For a few trends, you know, I think if you go back to even 10 years ago, there was the big customer service trend led by companies like Zappos, where it was all about making your customers as happy as possible and delivering happiness. And there was a shift, right? Before that, customer service was seen as just something you kind of had to do. And if you ever had to get on the phone with customer service with any company, you knew it was going to be a complete nightmare. And that started to shift to, okay, how do we support our customers? How do we make them happy? Then it shifted into being even more proactive in having customer success. How do you educate your customers? How do you set them up to be able to better use your tools or be successful in their career and in their lives? Of course, this all came up during the social media revolution. So people started becoming more connected than ever before. And so basically what we've seen is this trend of people being more empowered or customers being more empowered because we're able to talk to each other in greater and greater ways. Back in the day, and you know, you could go back all the way to the Industrial Revolution, people didn't have a way to really talk to each other at scale. If you had a bad experience with a product, you could tell, you know, the 10 people that you know, and it would kind of end there. But with social media, that just got accelerated and accelerated and accelerated to the point where if you treated customers really poorly, that reputation would spread very, very quickly and you would go out of business. And so out of necessity, they had to start really caring about customers and listening to customers and putting the focus on how to empower them. And that led all the way to, you know, community is kind of the ultimate manifestation of that, where you're not just supporting them, you're not just trying to make them successful, but you're actually trying to create a space where they can find that sense of connection, they can find a sense of belonging, they feel like they're a part of something, they even help you build the thing, right? And we got collaborative consumption, we got the Airbnbs, the Lyfts, the Ubers of the world, we got really large online platforms like, you know, Wikipedia, and you know, Shopify now, and GitHub, you know, these ecosystems where it's actually the community building the product itself. And so I think, like I said, community has always been a core part of how we create value for each other. Actually, if you look at the word company, the roots, the etymology of it comes from come together and penis over bread. It was how we came to, traders would come together and exchange goods over dinner, over meals. It's always been a core part of how we do business. It's just how we've come together and the extent and the scale, right? The scale that companies can build communities now really quickly and efficiently using a lot of the new technology that's come out to help you build online communities. It's just made it a big opportunity and something that a lot of, I think, customers and consumers are craving and looking for.
So as I mentioned before the podcast, some of the focus of this season is really around how leaders can mobilize a community for a purpose. So I'm keen to explore with you, how might a leader pinpoint that one idea with the potential to amplify the kind of influence required to ignite a community? And from there, what are the fundamental elements that make a community sticky enough to build momentum?
It's not. So in the world of business, I actually think sometimes we lean a little too heavily on purpose in the world of community. For business, I think sometimes a business will say, like, we have this really big vision, like we're going to transform education, or we're going to, you know, rethink how innovation happens, right? And then so like they'll start a community and say, this community is for people who want to rethink innovation or transform the education, the world of education. And then they launch a space and people are just like, cool, we're here. What do we do? What are we talking
now
about?
Now what?
And it's just so lofty. It's so big. Like that can work for, you know, social justice communities or political movements where you're really trying to create change. And so there's this big lofty purpose or vision. And what do people do? Well, they vote. They try to get other people to vote. They try to change policy. That's the action they can take. But when you're trying to, you know, change education or something like that, it's really hard to get people in a room to say, let's change education. Then they're like, great, what do we do here? How do we take action on this? It's too lofty. It's too big. And so what I recommend businesses do is to figure out, I like to call it their turpentine, from Picasso's favorite quote, if it actually came from him. Who knows if quotes actually came from people in the past anymore. But it's a great quote nonetheless, where he said that when art critics get together, all they talk about is theory and vision and purpose of the art. But when artists get together, they talk about where to buy cheap turpentine. Right. So you have to figure out, who are the artists in your community? Who are the people who are actually trying to do the work? They have a goal they're trying to accomplish. They have a problem they're trying to solve. There's a point they're trying to get to. What's that job they're trying to do? And then figure out, what are the questions that are coming up on a day-to-day basis for them? What's their turpentine? What's the thing that they're actually struggling with, that they actually want to talk to each other about? And start conversations around that. The purpose is in the background. The purpose is a reminder of why they're there. It's a sense of, we are part of this larger thing that brings us together, which is really important. But the day-to-day isn't about talking just about the purpose. It's about talking about the things that they actually care about in their day-to-day life.
And that really speaks to the idea that purpose itself is a verb. Like, you can't just retrofit a purpose. People need to own it, and they own it through the turpentine. Essentially, that is the action taking. That's the part of it that matters. And from what you're sharing, that's how people create that stickiness I just referred to, is through that shared action taking.
Exactly. And the purpose doesn't have to be this big lofty thing. I think it's another thing businesses do, is they have this real fluffy, big, we're changing the world thing, when, you know, there's like a community I just spoke to. It's a community for people who have tiny houses. And like, if you ask about the purpose, it wouldn't be like, we're trying to change the world through tiny houses. It's just like, we are all real. We just really love tiny houses. There's just something about them just that just gets us going. It's just so cool. Like, look how tiny this house is. And I get it. I've stayed in tiny houses with my wife. It's so much fun. They're delightful. You're just like in the middle of nature in this tiny little home that's somehow really efficient. And, you know, I think sometimes it's just a genuine curiosity for a topic, something that people love, and they just, it's something they're doing in their life that they want to have camaraderie around and have other people to share that passion with and talk to about that thing. You don't have to change the world with every community. The purpose can be really simple, really minimal. Sometimes it could even seem shallow, right? Like, people will hate on a community that's just all memes, but we need those kinds of communities as well. We need a diversity of connection. There's actually some research I read that says that, going back to social health, we need a portfolio of interactions, is what they called it. So, more so than just having a good friend that you talk to all the time, being able to say hi to your neighbor, having a place where you could just, like an improv class, where you could just be silly and have fun, going to your favorite internet forum where people are just making jokes the whole time, and then also being able to go to your therapy group and going really deep. We need different levels of community, different kinds of community. So don't get so caught up on your purpose needing to be this really deep, really meaningful, really lofty thing.
And just to your point, connection is actually the purpose. It's about the connectivity before anything else.
Yes, but I want to clarify that, because it's another sticking point for me.
Yep, layer it up.
A lot of the time, businesses will pitch community as the reason that you should come join their group, right? Like, come join our group. You'll find your peers. You'll find belonging. You'll find connection. What I've found is that people primarily join community for benefits, and then they stick around for belonging and connection. And so there's always belonging, or hope that you might find connection or belonging. That's always in the back of our minds. For some, that might be a small aspect to why they're joining the group, right? Like, maybe they're joining a group for accountants because they just like really have a lot of questions about how to use Excel, and they want to ask those questions and get answers. A very clear, practical benefit. But once they're in there and they start interacting with the same people over and over again, and they start helping other people and they feel that emotional connection, that's where they start to really value belonging. And even if you're someone who's actively seeking out belonging, like you're looking for new friends, you move to a new city, you're looking for people to connect with, you still are going to look for things that have a benefit you're interested in. Mm-hmm. You're not going to go to the pottery class if you don't care about pottery. You're not going to join a run club if you hate running, right? It still needs to provide a benefit first, and then belonging is what will keep you coming back and make it such an enriching experience for you.
Mm. And so this is a great segue into my next question. In the book, you referenced the spaces model, which essentially mm-hmm. outlines the measurable components of community success. Those included mm-hmm. support, product, acquisition, contribution, engagement, and success. Are you able to give our listeners an overview of the spaces model and share a few insights in, I guess, the most common mistakes that leaders and organizations can make along the way?
Yeah, totally. So again, community, big, broad, beefy term, right?
Yeah.
It means a lot of things. Really, on a fundamental level, from a business standpoint, it's the shift from we are going to do things for people and create things for people to we are going to help people create value for each other, right? I like to compare it to marketing. Marketing is how you distribute value to other people, right? It's like a broadcast, one to many. Community is how you connect them with each other so they create value for each other. It's many to many. And so that's something that you can apply to pretty much any part of business, right? Any part of business, whether it's you're creating your product, you're marketing, you're creating content, you have an approach where you just create all the value for people, or you could take an approach where they can create value for each other. There's a social solution to this problem. And so the spaces model was meant to help businesses understand the different areas that community can drive value for the business to help it achieve different goals. Because before that, businesses would always say, hey, we're just building community. And it would just kind of be loosely attached to lots of different goals. So we wanted to articulate it. So my team and I worked on creating the spaces model. And so to go through it, yes. Yeah, so first one, support. And so traditional support is one to many, right? Like someone has a question and they come to us and we give them the answer. They call us, they send us an email, something like that. The many-to-many approach is to create a space where people can answer questions for each other. So we see companies will launch a support forum, for example. Product. We may talk to people directly and collect their product feedback. A social solution to that is to host focus groups or create an online space where we can share new features that we're releasing and gather feedback from each other, have them try it, have them comment on each other's feedback. So we're creating a social solution to us learning how to improve our product. A is for acquisition. So we market ourselves, we create content, we run ads, we host events for people to learn about our product, to enter our pipeline, ultimately become customers. Taking a community approach to it is empowering your community members to self-organize local events, allowing your members to create content for each other, allowing your members to become ambassadors and advocates for you. So you're creating a social solution to how you grow your business. Contribution, C, is any platform where members are creating the content that makes your product. So you could think of like an Airbnb or a Lyft or an Uber, Wikipedia. These are examples where the content itself is contributed by the members. And so again, you know, Lyft or Uber could have just offered taxi services themselves, but they created a social solution. They empowered contributors. So anytime you want to build something and you want to empower a group of people to build it instead of you doing it yourself, you could take a community approach. E is for engagement. And so instead of us constantly emailing our members and constantly trying to like create content and keep our customers engaged ourselves, can we create an ecosystem, a community where they're coming to us anytime? Again, if it's an accounting community, when they have an accounting question, instead of going to Google or somewhere else, they can come to this community and it becomes a resource that they come back to time and time again. They become more engaged. They're more likely to stick around as a customer over time. And then success, similarly, success is about how do you provide customer success. So we can create courses for our customers and teach them how to use our product or how to be successful in their career. Or we could take a social solution and have our members teach each other, create guides for each other, mentor each other, proactively teach each other how to better use our product. Like the Salesforce Trailblazer community is a really good example of that, right? So all of these are just ways for a business to understand how do we take a problem that maybe previously we would just try to solve directly and see if there's an opportunity to create a social solution that brings in that connection, that camaraderie, all the additional benefits that a community can provide that us as a team or our content can't quite provide, because we can't provide that same level of peer support, breadth of feedback, personalization. There's things that communities can do that we just could never do. And you asked about a common mistake.
Yeah, the pitfalls.
I think one of the biggest, I think the biggest mistake is just trying to do too many of those things at once. To launch a community and say, great, we're going to get product feedback, we're going to grow, we're going to retain our customers, we're going to have people contribute to a product we're building. Each of those is an entire department in a company. Each of them will have different tools that you might want to use to build the community. There are different kinds of community programs, right? So like a support forum is going to look very different than a focus group, which is going to look very different than local events that you're hosting. So they're all different kinds of programs that can solve those problems, different tools, different metrics that are attached to it. And so what I'd recommend doing if you're working with a community team or you have people working on community in your company is just make sure that they have clarity on which one of those goals is most important to the company and which ones are community best suited to solve in the most effective way, and focus on those goals. You'll still impact the other stuff, right? Even if you have a event or support forum, you'll still get product feedback in it. It'll happen, but you don't want to make all six things a priority for your community team, because they're going to be spread very, very thin and it's setting them up for failure. Figure out the one thing that they can really deliver with community, get that right, and then add another goal and then add another goal.
I just want to loop back to our previous question for a moment where we were talking about stickiness in community. And you mentioned the attractorship, essentially. Like, it's one thing to have stickiness, but you've got to get people into the group in the first place. So how do you do that?
How do you get people into a community?
In the first place.
Yeah, I mean, most communities I recommend start really small and really hands-on, right? You're trying to build, I imagine it like a center of gravity, right? Like, once you have social density in the middle, people want to be a part of that. It's like, you know, it's not fully like high school, but not like high school, where like there's a group that, like, if people are look like they are really enjoying each other's time and they are you know, they like being together, there's a high social energy there, then you feel drawn to that. You want to be a part of that. You want to tap into that. And so you can do that by starting small and focusing on that social density, really making it clear who this community is for and who the community is not for, right? Exclude with empathy, because saying this is who this community is not for is what's going to make the members who are included feel like, oh, this is really for me and people like me. Being very hands-on, right? I would do one-on-one conversations. I would tap into the trust I already have with people, or really focus on building trust with those people, really understanding what their needs are, what their problems are, what their turpentine is, and then designing an intimate, small community experience that's highly, like, very hands-on and highly personalized to them, right? Like, who wouldn't want that community, right? If someone came to you and said, I just spoke to you and 10 people like you, I spent hours learning about your needs, and I'm going to spend a whole lot of time just trying to solve those problems, and all these people meet this certain bar that we've set for who they are, what their needs are, their experience, where they are in their careers or their hobbies or their life, whatever it is we're bringing them together around. And I'd love for you to be a part of that group. Would you be interested in joining? Who wouldn't want to say yes to that, right? So it's making it something that they almost can't say no to. And then you just get them in the room and you learn and you innovate and you adapt. You try, you know, a small discussion group and that one didn't work. Okay, maybe it was a topic. Let's try a different topic. Oh, that didn't work either. Okay, maybe small discussion groups aren't right. Let's try just asynchronous conversations for a while. Let's try a big group. Let's try a really facilitated experience. Let's try setting a goal that we're all trying to hit and working towards that goal. And so you just experiment and iterate the same way you build a product. you build a community. You just try things that you form a hypothesis on what you think is going to work. Try it. If it works, great. Now you can build on it. You can invite more people. And once you have that center of gravity and it's working and you really have community member fit, then you can start to turn the, you know, typical marketing engine on of how do we distribute our community through our website, through our emails, through our social media, through other conversations. Can we invite, can we ask our members to invite other members and give them referrals? Promote it at our events. You think about any way that you would promote a product, you can promote a community as well.
Mm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine one of the things...
I would never.
I imagine that one of the things that might be really scary for, you know, say a first-time community builder in terms of looking at the risks is this idea that everybody within that community has a voice. And as we know, human beings and human communication can be fairly unpredictable. So what guidance would you offer these people for navigating the unpredictable element of human communication, managing boundaries in the group and managing the flow of the conversation, particularly if you're someone who might want to control the brand messaging?
Yeah. I mean, if you're building a community, you're giving up control.
Yeah.
That's which a core premise
which is scary community. For all of us.
Yeah. It's, you're giving up control. I mean, one of the biggest fears that I hear from companies launching communities is, what if people say something negative about us? To which I reply, they're already saying negative things about you, just not in rooms where you are also present.
Mm.
So would you rather have those conversations happen in a space where you are there and you can partake in that conversation and you can say, thank you for sharing that. We really appreciate your feedback. I'm taking this back to the team right now. We're going to talk about this. And then you can come back a week later and say, hey, I spoke about this with the team. Here are the actions we're going to take to improve this. Thanks again for your feedback. How much better is that than them sharing that feedback in a quiet, dark corner of the internet where you have no idea what they're saying? When you're empowering them to host events, they're going to be creating, you have to give them guide rails. So you can set boundaries like, here's the branding guidelines for what you have to do. Here are our values. We'd like for you to share those values with everybody at the start of each event. All of our events must be free. Here's our policy on how to work with sponsors. You can set all those guidelines, but within those guidelines, within those guide rails is what I call them, those members have creative freedom. They can choose their own speakers. They can design it in their own way. They can be creative with the way they set up conversations. So it's about setting guide rails and then within those guide rails, letting people have control, have autonomy, feel like they have power, right? Because if they don't feel like they have power, then they're not going to be co-creating this thing with you. Then it's not a community.
Mm. Do you have any strategies while we're looking at how, I guess, essentially how we influence a community? Do you have any strategies or, I guess, case studies or examples where you've really had to inspire a community to change behavior or to adapt into a different direction or pivot in some way?
Yeah, I mean, communities are in a constant state of evolution, right? Mm. Like you're always going to be changing. You're always going to be evolving. You might change a platform. You might go from free to paid. You might go from small to big. Almost always that is a change you will experience, right? Mm. Going from small to big. My community was acquired, right? And we navigated that transition. So you actually have to transition. You have to change because if you stagnate, your community will no longer be relevant as your members' needs change, as the world changes, as other communities form that solve for different needs. So you have to innovate. You always have to evolve. I think there's a couple of tools that I use. There's a really great tool called the Community Commitment Curve, which actually started in the change management world. Mm. And the idea is that you're not going to get people to change by asking them to make huge sweeping changes all at once. What you want to do is make small asks while their level of commitment to that change are low, Just, you know, read this information, just consume, just learn, just small asks. You're not having to do too much. And then as their level of commitment goes up, then you ask them to make bigger and bigger, take bigger, bigger actions. You make bigger asks of them to, all right, now like join this group, or let's try this new process, or let's launch this new program. So I think if you're trying to like really change a culture or a process or something big like that, taking that slower methodical approach can be very effective. If it's a big, more abrupt change, then, you know, like an acquisition, then, you know, it's a lot about communication and making sure that members feel heard and they have a space to express their concerns. I'm doing a really big report, a big guide on how to sell a community right now, which is really fascinating. And looking at how these communities were acquired and how they navigated it with their community. And some of the best things that these community leaders did was just make themselves extremely accessible after making that announcement about that change. They would host Q&As in the forum. They would host events. A lot of them reached out directly to their core members, like the most active members in the community, and got on the phone one-on-one with them just to say, hey, this change is happening. I know these are probably some concerns that you'll have, so I wanted to talk through them with you and give you a chance to ask me anything you want. So people really just want to feel heard. They want to feel like they are part of that change, part of making that decision, or if not part of the decision, part of like their concerns are being heard and being navigated as you go through that transition. So just being really proactive at that kind of communication and making people feel like they're heard.
And to give context to that question, the reality is that we live in a world of relentless change. And so in some ways, these skills are vital for not only starting a community, but allowing that community to evolve in the context of the current climate. And so I want to talk about some of those trends. Now, I mentioned in my email setting up today's conversation that there have been a few future of work themes that I've been exploring as they emerge. And one of those themes revolves around remote working. Some leaders love it while others detest it, but it seems that to some extent it's probably here to stay. Now, I personally believe that remote working essentially offers organizations an opportunity to transcend the conventional boundaries of four walls and a business by delving more deeply into a community mindset, especially since a community inherently extends beyond these barriers. So I'm curious to know, what's your take on the intersection of hybrid working and the potency of community building as a strategy to redefine the business as usual framework?
The reality is, I don't think we can form as strong connections when we're working remotely as when we do in person. You know, we discussed earlier the very physical differences with talking on Zoom versus talking in person with somebody and the impact that has on your brain and your body. I've done a lot of research into serendipity, which is a really fun topic. And for serendipity to occur, you need lots of triggers, right? Lots of crossing paths with people and information. That kind of serendipity happens in an office a lot because you're physically crossing paths. You can see a lot more around you. You see a lot of different people. You interact with people outside of your usual team. When you're remote, it's much harder for serendipity to occur. You don't cross paths as much. You don't intersect with people outside of your regular meetings and your team. And so, you know, I think it's definitely brought us the ability to have more balance in our lives and more freedom and autonomy, which is a great thing. But from the perspective of how strong a sense of community is amongst our team with each other, there are limitations there. There are opportunities there as well. You know, if someone felt uncomfortable in an office, then allowing them to be working remotely from home may allow them to interact with people in a way that's healthier for them. For people with disabilities, it adds a lot more access and allows them to participate in these communities. I think that going back to what we said earlier about having a diversity of connection and a, you know, portfolio of interactions, I think for companies, they start, what they've been asking is like, well, how do we build stronger community through remote channels? And you should absolutely ask that. You should be thinking about how do we keep our employees connected and efficient at collaborating and feeling like they're a part of something. And I do think things like retreats and getting people together in person is really critical for that, even if it's only a few times a year. But what I'd like to see companies think about and start to prioritize is say, okay, well, they're no longer coming together in person. And so a level of connection and social health that they were deriving from work, they're no longer getting. How can we support our employees in being able to improve their social health by finding connection in other parts of their life? Can we support them in being more connected with their family and making sure they have time to spend with their family? Can we give them budgets and guidance on joining other social groups or letting them find social connection in other spaces in their life? Because I think if you only look at it in the one track of how do we get people to be as engaged in community as possible in our company, then you're going to end up with unhealthy employees from a social perspective. Employees who feel anxious, who feel depressed, who feel unhealthy, who are low energy, who are tired because they are not getting the social connection, the social health that they need. That's not a productive, effective employee. I think a lot of employees are getting burned out. We're saying it's because it's Zoom. We're saying because it's remote work. I think the underlying layer that people are missing is it's their social health. They're feeling isolated. They're feeling alone. So they're burning out and they're quiet quitting or loudly quitting. And so it makes sense. I think it's a smart investment for companies to invest in the holistic social health of their employees, which might actually mean deprioritizing connection in the company so that you can prioritize giving them a more balanced sense of community and social health in their entire life.
Yeah, I love that answer because there's so much to explore in relation to what it means to be a company. If you start to extend that definition to other places where people can connect beyond that, beyond those four walls, as long as that, as you've just said, that social connectivity is still at the forefront in the conversation, so that people are actually still able to be physically present and experiencing all of the emotions and all of the responses that we spoke about at the beginning of the conversation. So there's a lot to explore there.
Yeah. Real quick, I think it's actually a good shift too, because before remote work, you know, there's this trend to your work is everything, right? This like Googleization of the office where you come here for your friendship. We're going to do a happy hour. You can get, our doctors are here. You can get a massage here. You know, we're going to do a sports team. And it's just like, let's make our company as much of our employees' lives as possible. And what that did was really reduce the balance of our social diet to, you know, it's like we're just eating carbs and we're not getting their vegetables and we're not getting our fruit and we're not getting anything else in our diet. We're just getting this one form of social connection through work. And that's not good, right? Like that was also really bad.
Balance your social diet.
Exactly.
You need different foods.
It's important for businesses and work to understand where they fit in that balanced diet and realize that they're providing, they're very important, but they're not the entire diet. They're providing one piece of it, and it would benefit them to make sure that their employees have a healthy diet, almost to the extent that, like, get out of here, get out of the office, stop talking about work, stop thinking about work for the next, you know, 5-6 hours at your home with your family, with your friends and your hobbies. Like, how do we get you to disconnect from work so that when you're here, you are fully connected?
Yeah, it reminds me very much of a conversation that I had with Courage Expert. I've just released that episode. And he was talking about brand citizenship. So looking at a company as a country. And he was talking about it through a branding perspective. But what I liked about that idea is it, again, it extended the company beyond those four walls. So you might have a brand that's connected to a gym, that's connected to a cafe, and that you join, you know, you almost become a citizen of that brand through all of those different links. And I love it in relation to how we might go about balancing our social diet in that context. David, I'm coming to the last two questions in the podcast, but I'm really curious to understand how AI is impacting the community space, because all of a sudden we have a tool that has access to be able to analyze data at speed and potentially match people up and form communities in an entirely new way. What do you know about this space?
Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating time. So like everything else, there's pros and cons.
Yeah.
Some of the cons are that people are starting to rely on AI for relationships that they might have otherwise relied on other humans for. And they're relying on AI to solve problems that other humans would have solved for us. So it's another loss of opportunity to connect the same way humans used to connect around providing food for each other. And now we're so many layers removed away from our food source that we lost that connection. Our protection isn't from our neighbor, it's from a police department, right? And so now, like, a lot of basic information, you know, was replaced by Google for a while. And now AI is taking that to another level, where instead of asking a friend or your mom or a colleague for help with a question, you might ask AI. People are turning to it for romantic relationships as well. It's China. There's a study in China. There's an app there that is growing rapidly that's providing people with a romantic companionship. And so, you know, it's hard to have romantic companionship with people. Can we just use bots? Are there downsides to that? I think we might find that yes, there are. And so we're seeing that con. We're also seeing a lot of AI-generated content in communities, which is not good because the quality of that content is very low. Someone asks a question and all their answers are just generated by ChatGPT, which is kind of obvious and just kind of sad. I don't know if you've seen this or experienced this, but I'm even experiencing it on, you know, social media. If I post on LinkedIn, it's like so obvious that some people just use ChatGPT to come up with a response or a comment and they're just churning that out. So the overall quality of conversation is being impacted by that. That said, you gave a couple good examples there where AI, I think, can really enable community builders to do their work at scale at a much more effective level. Our limitation as humans is how much information we can hold in our brain at once. So if you have a community of hundreds or even thousands of people, you know, someone might come to me and ask me, hey, who do you know who works in the healthcare space and is building a community that's using this specific piece of software who lives in Michigan? And there's no way I can provide that answer in my brain. I try to, but it's very hard. AI can help you do that, right? It can actually pull all that information and say, oh, actually, here's somebody that fits all those things that could be a great person for you to connect with. And as a community professional, I can automate those connections and be able to connect members of my community with people who are highly relevant to them at scale. Going back to serendipity, you can engineer serendipity in a more effective way when you have access to more data. I think it's also helping us be more creative as community builders. You know, if you have to come up with content every single day, it can help you generate ideas for content. Again, I don't recommend just pasting content from ChatGPT in there, but you might say, like, yeah, give me 100 ideas for questions that people in this kind of community might have. And it gives you an idea and helps you understand what kind of content might resonate with them.
I think it's a tool designed to help us, not replace us.
It is, but it replaces parts of us, right? That's what we were talking about earlier. It replaces some part of us. So we have to be really aware of which parts it's replacing and how we're going to fill those holes.
So I've come to my last question for the day. What I'm wondering is, if you had access to the biggest billboard in the world, where you could write a single word or phrase that encapsulates your most profound realization or contribution to the world, What would you say and why?
Yes, it's Tim Ferriss' question.
I didn't know that, but I'll take that.
I think that's his. He does that in his podcast as well. It's a great question. I probably should have had an answer for it, given the fact that I've heard it in the past. I'll say what's coming to mind right now. It's something that I've been trying to remind myself of, which is life is a dance. Mm. I share that because I am a perfectionist. I am very goal oriented. I'm in a season of transition in my career. As I said, I did sabbatical. I stepped down from my company. I'm doing a lot of writing and researching and exploring right now. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and that brings me a lot of anxiety sometimes, not knowing, you know, what peak of the mountain I'm climbing up toward, what's the goal out there I'm running toward. But I always, when I remind myself, I forget who I heard say this, but life is a dance. Instead of thinking of it as a race to a finish line or some mountain that you're trying to climb, looking at it as a dance, it just helps me feel present. And it doesn't matter which way I go, I get very afraid of taking the wrong path, making a mistake that, you know, oh no, now I'm closing off all these other paths, or this was the wrong path, I should have gone a different way. When you look at it as a dance, there is no right or wrong path. You're literally just flowing and moving and, you know, moving in every direction. And I think that's a good way of looking at life.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. And for me, the right message at the right time, because I am also in a little bit of a transition. And I read one of your posts on LinkedIn where you were talking about that kind of search for clarity, and that sometimes it's just not there. And, you know, again, life is a dance. You're referring to that right now. And I actually found it so helpful to kind of just let go of this kind of grand pursuit for clarity and just be present and be like, you know what, the right thing will come at the right time, and just allow that to flow.
Yeah.
While on the subject of your LinkedIn, I have been following you for quite some time. You have some amazing resources on the internet, an awesome newsletter. Where can we find your work online?
Yeah, you can just find me at davidspinks.com. I write a regular newsletter. That is what I spend most of my time on right now. I'm very proud of it. Teaches people community building and human connection. And you can find all my other links from there on, I post regularly on LinkedIn and Twitter as well. And of course, you can grab the book, The Business of Belonging as well.
Definitely grab the book. Excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time today, joining me on the DNA of Purpose podcast. It has been such a joy to have you here sharing your wisdom and your wonder. And I hope you enjoy your continued sabbatical and your continued dance.
Thank you. I hope you do as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, David Spinks. Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maplad, that is MAKLAD, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.